any of my infamous jokes. I'm not going to tell any today because this is too serious a subject. Well, I might. I hope you liked the opening as well as I did. It was so nice to see our field presented in the broader perspective of what we really do, or of what we really ought to be doing, really talking about the outcomes of our activities. And so it's ironic to find me, if you've ever heard me on any subject before, you know that that's been my total concentration, is pushing us towards outcome. And today I want to talk to you about process, about how do you set up a process that will lead us to the outcomes that we have to deliver if we're going to properly serve our clients and employers. The irony of dealing with process is that it pushes us back into an arena that I think has been unpopular, if not anathema, to most of us. And that is, well, let me just tell it my own way. I used to really hate all this theorizing that goes on around our field. I mean, I used to say, look, you know, I mean, I have clients to serve. Let's get on with it. I was pretty stupid. Because the simple fact is that unless we have a theoretical framework for what we do, we're just kidding ourselves. Nobody, and certainly no profession, can function without some accepted norms which end up as a process arising from a theoretical framework. If you talk to an accountant, you know that whenever they get the data, they know what step one is, what step two is, what step three is, right down the line. Talk to an engineer. If an engineer does not follow the process, in fact, they won't be able to get their building licensed because you have to be sure everything is in place or the thing might fall down. Even a teacher cannot go before a class without a lesson plan, and probably today in good institutions, a lot more than that. And yet public relations people have been loath to come to any kind of a process that would move us along. Now, the marketing turf battle of the last decade, which I'm glad to find is now toning down, fortunately. I think we've both learned something from it. But even if you look at our marketing colleagues, they do have a process that they follow. I mean, you know, I can chart that process for you. If I'm doing marketing work for a client, for example, I wouldn't touch anything until, first of all, I drew my scales. I mean, down here, I want to know what's the cost factor of the product. Over here, I want to know what's the emotional involvement of the product. And up here, I automatically want to know, is this a one-time purchase? Is this a repeat purchase? And I would just automatically move every product or service through, as I hope you do, that kind of a process. Well, the question is, can we develop a similar process for public relations activity, considering the fact that we deal with so many variables more than any other profession? No other profession has as many variables to deal with for a very simple reason. No other profession has the whole universe to cover, and no other profession has the minute, both minute and minute by minute changes that can occur to upset the balance. I mean, the accounts numbers do not change. They are historical. This is what we did by September 30th, and that's it. There's no, you know, you may get somebody added wrong, and you'll get a slight change in there. Whereas, how long do your key players in a campaign stay with exactly the same feelings, mindset, information, whatever? Well, you know they're changing minute by minute. So we've got to take that into account. Second thing is, we've got to recognize that we're working in a non-linear system. This is a system where if you push it here, it may pop out over here. An engineering process has to be linear. I mean, God, I hope they build them linearly. I don't want to go in them or ride in them or ride over them unless they build them with a linear process. But our process cannot, by definition, be linear. And, by the way, that was the problem with the old communications theory, is it was absolutely linear. As if the world worked down this little narrow corridor, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. The third thing that I think we have to recognize, just let's be honest, And particularly, let's start educating our clients and employers to the fact that much of what goes on in this huge nonlinear environment, we cannot control, nobody can control. I really believe that when I look back at our own firm's problems, if we have difficulty with a client, it's usually because we have not tempered their expectations. We have not shown them, hey, you know, I mean, I'm sorry they started that out on the West Coast last week. I mean, I had nothing to do with that. But of course, the client, if you haven't sensitized them to that, you know, clients and employers figure, well, you're God of some kind. You know, push the button, take care of all that. And our buttons are very expensive. We push them occasionally. But what I know now, personally, and I want to share with you to the extent that I can, is that the only real flexibility in our practice, in fact, comes from having this framework. Because otherwise, I find I do two things. I spend all my time approaching each new situation as if it were indeed new, and I have nothing to go on, so I'm really reinventing the wheel every time, or what is worse, I take the last time I did it and I plug it in, but you heard my original ideas is that the whole world has changed, and so I've plugged in something, and I'm in trouble. Worse, my client is in trouble, and I have come to feel, you may or may not share this, I have come to feel that if we do not start doing things like this, we're calling ourselves a profession. If we don't start acting like one, then all of us are major violators of the ethics code. Because we're talking about fair dealing with clients, we're talking about honesty. I hope no third party decides to check a lot of us out on the real details of that against the things we sometimes imply to our clients and employers. Well, how might something like this work? First, because of the breadth of types of public relations practice, I think we need to talk just a minute about the environment in which public relations exist. In the last year or two, I've been increasingly impressed when I go back, all the way back, and take a real look at this whole environment in which we work. And here's what I'm finding. I'm finding that it all begins with a very basic statement that I really think we've overlooked, or at least we haven't sold it hard enough. I put it like this when I talk to clients. I remind them that success is not something that they can have a meeting and then come out of it and say, we decided we're a success. You know, you can't do that unilaterally. Somebody else has to do that. Now, when you think about this and think about organizations and think about all this economic BS that it's all the numbers or it's the sales or whatever it is, no. Far too narrow a view. Success can only be conferred on organizations, products, services, ideas, candidates, you name it. It has to be given by someone else, and those other people are outsiders. Success can only be conferred by outsiders. Now think about that. We all, of course, know this. We know that it's the customers, the opinion leaders, the neighbors, the elected officials, the vendors, the finance community, the voters, the prospective employers, employees, coalitions, stakeholders, stockholders, you name them. All these outside public. So what then really is the bottom line for every organization? It ain't money. Money is only how you keep score. We have a strong educational job to remind our clients that what comes out of this is a set of relationships or the failure to build a set of relationships, and the money is a direct result of the relationship, not the other way around. Now, I don't think we've sold that idea. I don't know if we've even talked about that idea. I'm afraid too often we've accepted the false norms set up by the management community, those wonderful, broad-based MBA thinkers. And we have not sold this idea, because if you had, and if you think about that, this implies some things that are pretty important for us. It implies, among other things, something that I know you love, a new definition of PR. Isn't that what we've always needed? I mean, come on! It implies that public relations, first of all, is both an art and a science. and I'll explain that later, but the key thing about the art and the science is that public relations is the art and the science of building relationships. That's the key word, building relationships that do two things. First of all, that earn trust, and then that motivate behavior. And this absolutely follows in behavioral science. You cannot expect behavior from people who do not trust you, or at least positive behavior. You can certainly expect behavior, not the kind you want. Well, now if we're looking at our field as really building relationships in order to earn people's trust so that they will be motivated to act in certain ways, that's a lot different, I think, than we've been talking about before. Notice what it says, for instance, about the communications function, particularly about the one-way communications function, which all the scholars tell us is still almost pandemic. 60-70% of all public relations activities, according to one study, are still one-way communication. Listen, stupid, let me tell you what you should know on my interpretation of what you should know. So, there's one other thing we know about the background. We know, and this comes out of a wonderful seminar. Oh, you should have been there. This was great. I'm in San Diego in January because San Diego State University and a firm in San Diego that supported the activity decided that the marketing public relations turf war had gone on long enough. We're going to bring this to a close. We're going to have a shootout. You know, and hell, the OK Corral isn't even in San Diego. I mean, it was a... Well, I was there representing public relations, and Philip Kotler, whose books you've all read, the guy who started the marketing turf war, and by the way, he's very upfront about that. You know, it started on campus. He says, us marketing people were being overlooked in the business schools and the other places where we teach marketing. We said, by George, we're going to put on a little PR campaign, and we're going to move out and get more. And he says, you know, I'm sorry it spilled off onto you, but we didn't really much care. And boy, did it succeed. If you look on campus at the rise of marketing in those 10 years, I mean, they really understood. I knew we were in good shape. Phil started off his remarks by saying, you know, marketing really ought to be called... Marketing really ought to be called public relations, he says, but you guys and gals got here first. Well, as we moved along with this, by the way, there'll be an article on this in the journal in I think a month or two, but if you want to know the outcome quickly, I don't want to keep you in suspense, only novels. Well, the outcome is very simple. Kotler promised that he will change what he's written in his 14 books. He said, look, you have to understand the context in which that occurred. He says, don't beat up on me, you guys. He said, I have learned a lot myself in this decade, and here's what I've learned. He says, I've learned that marketing has to be a very narrow, focused kind of activity. It has one public, customers, or two, if you want to say, customers and potential customers. And it is involved in research, in design, in those straight customer kind of communications, and maybe, he says, going a step beyond in the relationships with a customer after they buy. But, he says, here's what I've learned. He says, public relations is involved with the whole universe. And public relations' goal is to build hospitable environments in which we can market. And he says, what I've got now a casebook full of is situations where the marketing was great, but it failed because they had not built the hospitable environment. This is Phil Kotler talking, not Pat Jackson. I let him say it, you know. Out of that anyway, we took a look then at what are the arenas within which we practice within organizations to see what the proper role of public relations really is. And we agreed among the group of us there that there are really three arenas. I was driving this process a little, I admit. You know, us PR types... And that the first arena is the one where we do meet marketing of sales support. We do run into that gang there. Maybe if I can get this thing to work and not fall up. They got everything in here but a glass of water and a podium. Have you noticed that? Isn't it wonderful? The high-tech meeting room. Let me see if I can show you this in a way that may make it easier. Can you see that at all?
Yeah.
Okay. The first arena is sales support. Now, remember, public relations is always a staff function. We are not a line function, with one possible exception. If you worked for PRSA, where, as we all know, all you get for your dues money is the journal, then I suppose the journal is a product, and maybe the editors of the journal have a line function, okay? And you may be in a membership organization or something where that's the case, but that's a minor detail. See, Mike Canning never let you down. He's the guy who talked me into doing this. Thank you, Michael. Would you go get the podium now and bring that down? No. Now, sales support is where we do meet marketing, and frankly, let's be honest. Marketing and public relations are both secondary there to somebody else that in the last 10 years we have pushed right down into the ground. Sales. I don't give a damn how good the marketing is and the public relations. I want to know, did you sell anything? As Red Motley used to say, nothing happens until somebody sells something. And so we put both marketing and public relations into their proper staff function under sales. And we have to admit, marketing is in the driver's seat there. Because they design the product, they do the market research, and our job is to support them. And frankly, even though as much as 75% of public relations practice is marketing support, all that tells us is that organizations are losing huge opportunities by letting their public relations resources be concentrated on that because, frankly, we had to admit there are other people doing that along with us, and if we went off and did something else, they probably wouldn't need it. I mean, some companies even have salesmen who go make calls, for instance. You see? Now, if you move over into public policy, however, the second arena, that's our turf. Who is it that has to see to it that public policy enables the organization, product, service to exist, to survive, to prosper? That's us. We're in the driver's seat. Marketing, for example, has nothing to do with that function at all. We have to fight off a few stupid lawyers along the way, but outside of that, that's our bailiwick. And thirdly, and today by far, I think most important, is organizational effectiveness. If the employee family, retirees, their families, whoever's in your family. If you're in a college, hopefully some alumni at least feel like they're part of the family and not just permanent critics. Those people, if we can't get them on the team, inevitably we're in trouble. We know that. Now, the thing about this paradigm of the three, think if you will, we couldn't find any other arena in which we practice. We're either doing sales support, working on public policy, or organizational effectiveness. Now, here's the interesting thing. This is an absolutely seamless web. You cannot take away a piece. Even if we may not do the sales support, somebody has to do it. But that's the good news and the bad news. If organizational effectiveness is not attended to, do not expect to do good work in public policy for long or in sales support. As I said, it's a non-linear system, which, by the way, raises some interesting questions. We'll talk about those interesting questions in a minute. Now let's just back off from this. We've got this global situation where success has to be earned, where public relations really then means building relationships that will last over time and not just be a quickie, I like you now, but I forgot about you next week. And that we can practice it in three arenas. That's the environment in which we exist. What does this imply for us? First of all, I think it implies that public relations now has moved into an arena where we indeed should be dealing with all relationships that are acted out in a public setting. All relationships, all the way from two people up to masses of people. Now, why do I say that? Well, stop to think about your own situation. Have you ever been in a case where your work with larger external publics was beautifully done, but two managers inside the organization were doing this, and you sat there cooling your heels on the sideline while these two people, you know, solved their little turf war disagreement? Nobody's ever been in that spot, right, except me? Okay, what have you had to do Well, most of the time, you know, we just kind of sit there and wait until they kiss and make up. And as soon as they kiss and make up, they turn to us and say, well, why isn't it done? And you say, yeah, but well, I couldn't because, what do you mean? Us fighting? I mean, you know, you should have this all done. Because of being in situations like that all the time, we just learned OD techniques. And as soon as we run into this, after all, this is a public relationship between these two people. As soon as we find that, we make an organization development intervention with those two people. That's part of our bailiwick. Maybe it's your CEO and the senator from your state. I don't know who it is, but it goes all the way from two people to the universe. Because remember now, we're not communications people. You can hire and fire them. We're relationships people. And so I'm viewing this that we're going to take up that challenge, hopefully sooner and not later. It begins then, oh, and by the way, I guess I should just warn you, if all this seems awfully simple, maybe even simplistic, watch out. The implications here run very deep. For instance, if it's a seamless web, why do we have all these artificial divisions of labor within public relations departments or within organizations? Why do those wonderful personnel people in some organizations end up doing the employee and retiree relations, meaning the usually employee-retiree non-relations or bad relations? Well, I don't know, maybe that's an unfair statement. Everybody here that has a human resources department that is really wonderful, please raise your hands. Well, maybe they, oh, you got one? Lucky, you are so lucky. By the way, the marketing war may be over, but the new turf war is public relations and human resources. As you may know, the American Association of Personnel Administrators on September 1st changed their name. They're now the American Society. See, they're not just a trade association anymore. They're like us. They're professionals. The American Society of Human Resource Professionals. That's what they are now. So if you're not dealing in that arena. But this is really subversive stuff if you go back even a step further and think of this idea of success having to be conferred and that the real bottom line for every organization is its relationships. So don't take it too lightly. Now, I know what you're thinking. You've probably already heard more than you want to. You're probably like old Ethel Barrymore when they wanted to give her 75th birthday party. Somebody called up and said, we'd like to give you this party. Would you come? And she said, well, sure, I'd come. And they said, well, we thought we'd serve steak. You know, would that be okay? Well, that would be okay. We thought we'd have a birthday cake. Yeah, that would be fine. And we thought we'd put a lot of candles on it. And she said, wait a minute. I said I'd come to a birthday party, not a torchlight parade. That's kind of where we are here. Now let's take a look. I think I can get it all up here. Can you see this, by the way? Having kept you in the dark for a long time, I now ask you, can you see this? Let's take a look now at the model on which a process system has to be based. It will bring in behavioral sciences along with what we already know about communication and organizational behavior. First, let's look at the old model. The model that most of us have used is the old stimulus organism response model from our friends, the biologists. We change it a little bit. This becomes a sender, you know, this becomes an audience. This becomes a, well, still response. You know the whole business, and down here under the sender is the medium and the message, and then if we send that out and it strikes the audience, then the audience has an intervening factor here of attitudes and those things, and maybe they get enough to respond, and they send us feedback. Notice how linear that is. It's all totally linear, as if the world were, in fact, communications or were messages. This is now totally discredited among communications professionals themselves. And the reason is simple. If you're a doubter, if you're an old journalism grad, a communications grad, and you think, oh, hey, that's the real stuff, then you want to know what Dick Willett, a very prominent communications researcher, told the International Communications Association at its summer meeting, I think it was 2 years ago. It started fistfights in the bar, I know, so it must have been powerful. Well, he got up in front of his colleagues and he said, friends, I have bad news. 50 years of our research is down the tubes. It doesn't work. Popular kind of a message, you know. And here's why, he said. Think about it for a minute. He says, you and I study, and public relations practitioners do, the creation of messages, which, he pointed out, is a cranial activity. It takes place in that very little forepiece of the brain. So then we send them, and somebody, if it breaks through the clutter, which of course today is very doubtful, but if it does break through the clutter, they receive them in the fore part of their brain, and then they think about them in the fore part of their brain, and they may or may not give us feedback into the fore part of our brain. And he says, it's all taking place right up here in this little piece. And he says, that's not where people live. People live down here, the gut, the heart, the rest of us. And we've got a model here that deals only with the cranium. You know, he said, we should be brain surgeons, not communications people. So what should the model be? Let's back up a minute then and say, well, okay, if that isn't the model, that model's now a dead issue. What is the real model? Well, we talked back here that the goal of public relations is to motivate behavior. I thought Harold Burson made that point rather clear this morning in his introduction. He said it depends on the actions that result when some activity is undertaken. We'll argue about whether or not it's behavior later, but I think it's, well, what else could it be? Does it really matter what people think about your product unless they're buying it? Does it matter whether they, you know, are really quite favorably disposed towards your organization, and as soon as you propose some activity, they're out going door to door campaigning against it? What the hell does that matter? It's not important. Only thing that counts is behavior. So let's see if we can do a model now that supplants that other one and will work for us. I think we can pretty simply. I think, first of all, we've got a column here, that first box, I'm going to call perception. Now, this is perception about the potential behavior, because again, I'm not in the library business. I'm not in the encyclopedia business. I don't care how much superfluous information my work puts into the heads of our target public. I'm not in that business. I'm not in the entertainment business. Hell, the news media have taken that over. They own the entertainment business today. I'm in a very direct, targeted activity of trying to stimulate people's behavior, so let's talk about their perceptions about behavior. Now, what goes into perceptions about behavior? Well, there's thoughts, there's beliefs, there's values, my gosh, I could go on and on. There's opinions, there's attitudes, there's experience. Oh boy, is that the big one, and we overlook it entirely. We're always thinking it will change their attitudes when their own experience tells us, I wouldn't trust your company if you changed my attitudes 40 times over because I bought your product 10 years ago and it didn't work. Then, of course, there are little things like emotion, and intuition. See what I mean? I mean, the variables here are incredible. And I could go on and on. You don't need me to go on and on. That's what we're talking about, is what forms people's perceptions. The cranial is part of this here, but that's about all. Now, all of this comes together down here in a box that I will call latent readiness to behave. Now, wait a minute, damn it. I'm a consultant, and I get a lot of money for having phrases like this, and I don't want any criticism. You know, that really is what we're talking about. What is a result of this set of perceptions is a person's or a target public's latent readiness to behave either immediately or at some point in the future. If you're working on a voting campaign, the way Bob Teeter was talking about, what the campaign is working on people's latent readiness on voting day, A, to vote, to give the behavior, and B, to give the specific behavior that you want, voting for your candidate. And all during the campaign, there is no other behavior they can give you, except maybe you could sign them up as volunteers. That's a different kind of behavior. But for the great majority of people, you see what you're shooting at? You're building their latent readiness to go do it on November whatever. And that's what it's about. Now, if we think about our work this way, it's a lot different. Because I think today we send all these messages out as if everybody's going to drop everything and say, oh my God, You know, I'm going to run right out and pay my gas bill. I mean, it's really... Now, here's the problem. Here's behavior over here. That's the goal. The one and only goal. And so our model now is to deal with people's perceptions so they get a positive or negative, depending on what we want to do, latent readiness, which when the triggering event occurs, they will give us the behavior. Now, triggering events, obviously there are some triggering events that are every day. I mean, some of you are dealing with products that are sold regularly. You hope the triggering event is right now. If you're dealing in issues, often. If you're dealing in employee or other kind of organizational effectiveness with shareholders, usually there's some lead times in there. So this is really a different way of looking at what we do, which, by the way, is a bottom line kind of a situation. Remember, there's no fluff in here. There's nothing soft about this. We can stand up with any accountant, any lawyer, any marketer, any engineer and say, hey, this is hard stuff. We're talking about behavior now, not talking about anything else. We're not talking about informing them or making them feel good. That's way over here. If we do that, it's as a way station to get here. And that's the only reason to do it. I mean, unless, you know, you do work for the encyclopedia. Now, here's the problem. The problem is in the intervening area between latent readiness and behavior. What are the circuit breakers here that either make behavior occur or make behavior not occur? And at the highest sophistication of our work, what can we possibly do here that will make people give us behaviors that are out of sync with their perceptions? Yes, that is entirely possible. The behavioral psychologists have told us beyond a shadow of a doubt that while most behavior will flow along the line that I have drawn here, perceptions will lead to a latent readiness, will eventually lead to a behavior. Many times, if we can give immediate behavior, we may go from straight to perception to behavior, but in many cases, something happens over here where this whole thing goes round and round and they give us a behavior which is totally different even than the perception in the first place. Now, that's probably hopelessly confusing, so I'll get off that and get on to something that's less confusing. Let's look at what these circuit breakers are here. Peer pressure. You got my perceptions right, but it's too risky. It's never been done before. I have a simple misperception. I don't understand, in other words. I'm too busy. It's not relevant to me. My self-interest, or it's in my self-interest, it's against my self-interest. The whole triggering event syndrome that occurs in the middle. Now, you know, I could refer you to 682 psychology and sociology tests, and I know how you all love to read that stuff. I won't. I just ask, at least for your willing suspension of disbelief, on 2 points. 3 points, really. First, that this is our goal. If you're still working for something else, friend, you are so vulnerable. So vulnerable. Because nothing else matters. And secondly, that this is the piece that we need to know about behavioral science in order to get people to this state of positive latent readiness so that they can behave. And thirdly, that we also then, of course, as always, need to reinforce the behavior once it's coming. People won't just keep doing it because they did it once and it seemed like a good idea. If you'll go along with me to that extent, and, you know, if you think behavior isn't important, I'll tell you my favorite old story you've all heard about the nun. Remember the nun. Never forget her. That's the best way to remember that behavior is what we're doing. Remember the nun that worked in the hospital, and her job was to deal with people's spiritual health while the doctors dealt with the physical health. Remember her? And she wasn't very good at her job. She hadn't had a lot of PR training and so forth, persuasion. And so one day on the way home from work, remember, her car ran out of gas? You all remember that story, remember? And the only thing she had in the car was a bedpan, and she went and she filled it up with gas, and she came back, and she was filling up her car. And two of the people she'd been working on all week, remember, up in the window, they saw her, And they looked down there, and they were incredulous. They came running out across the lawn in their little, you know, hospital johnnies, and they stood there for a minute. One of them said, "Sister, you have not been very persuasive, but if that thing starts, I'm converting tomorrow." That's what I'm talking about. It's behavior that matters. Now, what's the model? What's our process model for making that happen? One that we can use every time, whether we're doing a tiny little piece, something for our newsletter, because we've determined that there's an awareness factor here and they really need just to get some awareness started, or whether it's a huge behavior modification campaign. What's the model? Well, try this one on for size. The first step is to find out, to really ask ourselves, what is the desired behavior that we're after? Instead of sitting down and writing something right away or doing all those other things we do, let's begin by asking, what's the desired behavior I'm after? Now, you have to do this, though, in an interesting way. First, you need to know what's the ultimate desired behavior. Is it sales, for example? Oops, but I phrased it wrong. The behavior isn't sales. The behavior is purchase, isn't it? What's the purchase that I want you to make? What's the vote I want you to give? Whatever the ultimate behavior that we're driving for is, that now is the ultimate goal by which we are going to be measured as practitioners. And don't fool yourself if you aren't being measured that way already. It's common. Company after company, hospitals I know, school districts I know, are starting to measure their public relations activity based on that. That's the first step. The second step is, what steps are necessary to lead to that behavior? In other words, people don't just automatically give you a purchase. That's silly thinking. The marketing people would never do that. They know, for example, that first there's got to be an awareness factor. And then maybe once we make them aware, depending on the kind of product or service or candidate we're selling, maybe our next behavioral goal is to get them to come to a meeting. Maybe our next behavioral goal is to let someone go and talk to them. And that all we're asking them to do is, hey, let someone come and chat with you. Maybe it's to get them to read something. That's possible. All kinds of intermediate steps. But the problem is here, to really put our energy in here. This is easy. That'll take you a minute. This is tough. If a purchase is our goal, how do we move them along the steps toward that purchase? Because anything short of that is the old silver bullet theory, that people go from zero to purchase just overnight. Now, that may be true if you're selling 50-cent candy bars. Maybe then this is a different model for you, or a quicker model. But most of what we're working with today, particularly as we move into public policy and organizational effectiveness, isn't quick like that. And so we need to outline those steps. And when we've done that, we're now a lot closer to where we're going. Because the third question we need to ask ourselves, of course, then is, whose behavior do we need? Who really can give us the behaviors at the intermediate steps and at the ultimate steps? So that our target publics are super targeted. Now, this is not an easy question. It's just like target marketing. And as Harold Burson said this morning so eloquently, if we aren't really using research, at least here, we're just kidding ourselves. We're still believing in the mass communication and the silver bullet, and you throw it all out there and somehow it hits people, I don't know how. When you start talking about your super targeted publics, now you're talking about a process that takes some time. It takes some thinking there. And this is why public relations is a science now. You don't just sit down and say, gosh, you know, what wonderful phrase or illustration can I come up with that'll just knock them off their feet? It isn't going to happen. There aren't six cases in history where a super phrase or a super illustration or whatever, you're trying to sell something positive. You see? But think of yourself, how many phrases or whole volumes have really had the kind of impact we believe all the time our little brochure is going to do. It's just not going to happen that way. So when we super target today, I certainly don't need to tell you this, but I will anyway. When we super target, of course, we make a list of the most segregated publics we possibly can do. I mean, it's just hopeless anymore. I sometimes deal with, say, healthcare people, and they'll have down as a public, they'll have doctors. That's a joke. Have you ever met a time when all the doctors would share the same interest on a common problem? Hell no. So you got to separate the podiatrist, you know, from the orthopedics people. You got to separate the doctors on the west side of town from the doctors in the suburbs. You got to separate the doctors that practice at St. Joe's from the doctors that practice at Hometown General. Because each of those has a different situation back here that we need to take into account because it leads them to a different approach, in most cases, to latent readiness. Now, that isn't to say if the state legislature said we're going to put on a special income tax of 35% for all doctors, that's a hell of a good idea, but supposing the state legislature said that, they would probably then share a common interest. But it's rare that we run into those today, so we need lists of publics like we have never had before, down to the cell group of three or four, if you can find them. And I'm not seeing that in most of our practice. I'm still seeing this mass approach as if people thought alike, shared the same latent readiness motivators, and there they were. Well, let's assume we stop doing that now, and we really know who we need to go through the intermediate steps to give us the desired behaviors. Then fourth, we need research again. We need to know where they are on a latent readiness scale. In other words, are they almost ready? Maybe they're almost ready. Maybe they're not almost ready. Makes a hell of a difference. And we've just been throwing stuff out there as if they were all maybe in the same situation. It's so much easier to target them, do some research as to where they are on the scale, and then deal with that certain group that's ready first. They need one message. People who aren't ready at all, who don't even know the product exists, the company, whatever it is, they need another kind of relationship builder, whatever it is. There's just two more steps. The fifth step then is, having sorted out our publics and knowing where they are on the latent readiness scale, now we need to ask ourselves, what type of campaign do we need to reach them? If some of you who have heard some of us who've thought about this say that you can only deal today with maybe a half a dozen key publics in a year, do you see why? I mean, you know, in order to really move people to behavior, you need to narrow down the number of people you're going after. And this is why, because we need that kind of information. Otherwise, we're just throwing money away. There are six types of campaigns. If you're interested in that, let me just share what we know about the different types of campaigns. As soon as I find the damn transparency, I'll be glad to show it to you. There are six types of campaigns, essentially. And these campaigns are based on the resistance of people to give you behavior. If people are all ready to give the behavior, they just need to be reminded a simple awareness campaign will work. Or, notice again, not if everybody, but if some of the target publics here are on the latent readiness scale, why not go to them first, right off, and get them to give us the behavior, right now? So often I think we start out with the toughest publics, or assuming that everybody is in the tough public. Preach to the choir first. They're ready. Get them to go. Other people.